Any questions? Nominations must be received by 5 p.m. on March 18th, 2013. New cab members will then be selected by the local station board. Serving on the cab or urging your friends and coworkers to do so is a great way to help your community and KPFA.
You're listening to KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, and 88.1 KFCF in Fresno.
Welcome to the Morning Mix. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. It is Friday, March 8th, 2013, International Women's Day. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today we interview Tukufu Zuberi, professor of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and Brian Murphy, a professor in the Department of Communication Studies at Niagara University, on contemporary issues and misunderstandings regarding Africa today. Additionally, we will hear from Kate Raphael of Women's Magazine, who will talk with members of the Women's Vocal Ensemble Kitka, who are holding a special International Women's Day concert this weekend. And we will end the show speaking with Inder Grewal, a student at City College of San Francisco, addressing accreditation issues and a threatened closure of the campus there. Welcome back to the Morning Mix. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today, in the first segment of our program, we're going to be speaking with Tukufu Zuberi, professor of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and Brian Murphy, who's live in studio as a professor at Department of Communication Studies at Niagara University, on contemporary issues and misunderstandings regarding Africa today. Additionally, we are going to hear from Kate Raphael of Women's Magazine. Those of you in the KPFA audience here know Women's Magazine airs Monday at 1 p.m. Pacific. Kate Raphael has a pre-recorded interview talking with members of the Women's Vocal Ensemble Kitka, and we're holding a special International Women's Day concert here this weekend in the Bay Area. We'll end the show talking about City College of San Francisco and accreditation issues threatening closure of the campus. But first, here's Peter to introduce our first segment.
With us in studio today is Brian Murphy, who's a professor in the Department of Communication Studies at Niagara University, where he helped found the department's degree in communicating for social justice. He's a longtime reporter out of South, Central, and Western Africa, works for 10 years there with Interpress, writing for magazines like New African and Africa Business. He's a founder and executive director of the Southern African Regional News Service and African Information Online. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
Tukufu Zuberi is an American sociologist, a filmmaker. He's a professor of race relations and chair of the sociology department and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Zuberi has appeared in several documentaries on Africa and African diaspora, including Liberia, America's Stepchild, and 500 Years Later. He's produced the new film African Independence, which premiered at the San Diego Film Festival this year and won Best Documentary and Best Director. Tukufu, are you with us?
I am.
Well, thank you very much, and let's start with you. Tell us about your film, African Independence.
So this is a film about the most important thing to happen on the African continent in the 20th century. And it's kind of not recognized for its significance, and much has been lost in appreciating the tremendous part that Africans have played in the redefinition of freedom, humanity, and where we stand today in the world. You know, often today when people look at Africa, they look at it with a lot of pity. And this pity is drawn from the ability only to see poverty, only to see disease, and only to see war. And I think that at some point we need to move to a politics which is more empathetic. People need to understand and be able to put themselves in the place of Africans as they transform Africa from its brutal past of imperial rule by the European world.
Your film is going to be showing at the Oakland International Film Festival, and you're scheduled for April 6th. So we're excited about that, and hope to meet you then.
I'm excited, too. I'm coming home. I was born in Oakland.
I read that. So you grew up in Oakland, and here you are coming back. That's wonderful.
I grew up in Tasfarenga, which is right down the street from one of the Panthers' offices. Went to Highland Elementary School and Oakland High School. So, you know, yes, I'm very excited about that and very excited about being able to come home. And I do hope people come out and check the film out.
Brian Murphy is in studio with us. He's professor at Communication Studies at Niagara and a longtime journalist all over Africa. Brian, I'm going to throw this question to you about the enormity and diversity of Africa, because I heard you describe that to my students on Wednesday night when you spoke at Sonoma State, and then we'll get back to Tukufu.
Yes, I think that one of the things that people have to understand is that there are more than 50 nations in Africa, and each one is unique. Although some nations share cultures across boundaries, most of them have developed their own political culture, their own social process. And since independence, that has been one of the most exciting things to see in Africa.
Tukufu Zubairi, let's go back to you briefly and talk about, I know your film spans several major events and looks at African independence from World War II, the end of colonialism, the Cold War, and the beginning of the era of African republics. Can you give listeners maybe a brief synopsis of what's going on in the film? And also, again, I'm thinking of this, especially given that it's going to be a local showing here April 6th. That'll give people maybe more ideas about what's going on. Maybe come out and see the film.
Yeah, and the thing is that I agree that there are these 54 African nations, last count. And who knows, there could be more as we move on. But that Africa is one of the places in the world which has been most brutally impacted by the legacy of colonialism and enslavement. So look what happened to Africa. Enslavement took tens of millions, maybe as much as 100 million souls off the African continent, dumped a lot of them in the Atlantic Ocean, some more in the Mediterranean, and Africans went and served as a source of free labor to help accumulate the wealth of those who would later come back and colonize the African continent. And what did colonization mean? Colonization meant inequitable interaction with the world. So the world ripped off Africa's resources and used it to build up their countries. And the United States didn't just build itself independently. It benefited tremendously from the slave trade and has continued to benefit up until today tremendously from inequitable kinds of trade and other relationships that it has with Africa. So Africa is that place. Africans all over the continent began to stand up in a movement which spread all over the continent. And in this movement, and it rose differently in different places, but one thing that was very consistent about it, and that is giving Africans a voice in ruling themselves and removing the classical imperialism which destroyed things on the African continent. And independence was an effort to correct those things. Just as the civil rights movement in the United States was an effort to correct the barbaric forms of Jim Crow, which created the segregation and other forms of oppression, which were so devastatingly negative on the African-American community in the United States. So the independence movement is a tremendous voice in creating a new definition of what it means to be a human being. And that is very important. It's very important that we embrace that tradition, and it's very important that we allow people to appreciate that this is Africa's big contribution to the world, and we need to redefine many of the relationships that exist, because many of them are based on these old paradigms of colonialism, these old paradigms of imperialism.
We're speaking with Tukufu Zubairi, professor of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and also Brian Murphy, a professor in Department of Communication Studies at Niagara University. And this is the Project Censored Show on The Morning Mix. Peter?
Tukufu, this is International Women's Day, and I'm aware that certainly in Liberia and to a certain extent post-genocide Rwanda that women have taken active roles in the government. But can you generalize, and this is probably impossible to do, you know, the condition for women in Africa overall, and do we see good examples like in Liberia?
So I think a generalization would distort the types of ebbs and flows of progress that have definitely been taking place for the conditions of life of African women. But it is fundamentally important to recognize that African women have always played a critical role in transforming African societies. During the colonial period, there was a heavy reinforcement of almost every patriarchal or male-dominated form of relationship that existed on the continent. So in some ways, what colonialism did and what enslavement did was pervert social relationships on the African continent. So women and their place in the society was relegated even further, relegated to a sideline, even though they did most of the work, most of the rural work, most of the farming, most of the labor, most of the child care, most of all of these things, which were critical to sustaining the society. So I think that it's one basic thing is to say that African women have been fundamental to the basic standard of life in Africa. At the same time, I think it is critical to recognize that the oppression and domination and relegation of the labor and work of women has not stopped, that the relegation of that to some subordinate status has not stopped. And it's not only, you know, in Liberia, it's not only in Rwanda, it's not only in South Africa, it's not only in Mozambique, where we see, or Kenya, or, you know, many African nations where you can find women have engaged in political roles and are in excelling and becoming leaders in different political processes and in governments and in political parties, etc. But I'm reminded of my interview, which is in the film, of Samina Nkrumah, who is Nkrumah's daughter, who is currently the chairperson of what was Nkrumah's party, the Convention People's Party. And she's very politically active and has, you know, kind of really asserted herself, and she's a brilliant woman. But one of the things she said is that it's very important to recognize that the status and the role of women is in transition, because women are gaining education, and as they enhance their education, they are asserting themselves more. But also there is the struggle to change women's positions. So there's plenty of political protest which is occurring in various African nations. And this results in the political participation of women in various cases in exceptional ways. I mean, you know, you had the Prime Minister of Mozambique. We don't talk much about Mozambique, but you had the Prime Minister of Mozambique. You had the President of Liberia. So you do have those kinds of exceptional situations. You have African women who have won Nobel Prizes because of their work in preserving the environment, their work in advancing the cause of peace on the African continent. So I think there is no doubt that women are, and that women are taking a new initiative to assert their very solid contribution to the future of Africa. And, you know, even you take a young woman like Samina Nkrumah, who is basically this new generation of women who are no bars hold, demanding equality for women and addressing the particular questions which women are confronted with and trying to integrate them into the front of the agenda of various African nations, Ghana being one example. And so I think that the status of women is still not where we would want it to be, and definitely not where women can continue to tolerate it, but that women themselves are engaged in transforming this situation. A lot needs to happen. A tremendous amount needs to happen. I mean, the rates of certain diseases that impact Africa, They tend to impact women and children even more so. And, you know, there is the dreaded disease that people really talk about these days is HIV/AIDS. But along with that, malaria, meningitis, and these things, you find that these forms of plagues have a tremendously negative impact on the life experience of African women.
I'm going to ask Brian to comment on women in Africa from his experience, and then we want to move to AFRICOM and U.S. Involvement there.
Well, I would agree completely. Since my first days of reporting on Africa, although there are exceptions, on the whole, one of the success stories of post-independence Africa is the empowerment of women and girls. Development, their access to education, programs that have focused on the diseases that have affected them, that's a story that does not get told enough. And I think it's something that more focus should be put on, and I look forward to seeing this film because I'm hoping that some of it will be looking at these success stories.
Brian Murphy, let's also switch gears here a little bit and discuss AFRICOM, and if you could tell our listeners a little bit, what is AFRICOM, and I suppose some from an historical perspective, we can just see this is just a sort of a reassertion of Western colonial or neo-colonial authority in Africa, a relabeling of places. Could you talk more about that?
Okay, well, AFRICOM is a military acronym, and as most people know, the Pentagon has divided up the world into various military commands. For example, the European command is EUCOM. AFRICOM is the newest of the Pentagon's designations of a part of the world for military treatment. The most people have, if they've heard about AFRICOM, they've heard about it in sometime in the last 5, 6, maybe 7 years as it's become more public. At least one large base has been set up. Military treaties have been signed with a number of governments. But in fact, the process that's brought AFRICOM into being in Africa has been a 20-year program developed inside the Pentagon at a time when, at the end of the Soviet Union, Pentagon thinkers, policymakers, redrew the map of the world in trying to focus on places they thought could be trouble. And as they were doing that, they came around to realize that many of the nations in Africa could be trouble for the United States in economically, politically, somewhere down the road. And so over time, a series of strategies were evolved by the Pentagon to start thinking about how we could control the possibility of crisis, strife that could affect American business and American political designs on the continent.
And this affects actually many people in the United States and in the West technologically. We really have modern-day slavery in the African continent, ongoing problem there for centuries, in fact. And also coltan and coltan mining and cell phone technologies and so on. I mean, this is becoming more and more a ubiquitous phenomenon driving this behavior.
That's right. And one of the things that we have to take into consideration is that coming back to talking about colonialism and post-colonialism, many of the nations that had imperial designs on Africa were not the United States. They were from Europe and had always been. And the United States and American business actually had few large interests outside oil and a few mineral resources in Africa. In the early 1990s, a group of corporations that wished to penetrate these areas, for example, mining coltan, got together a lobby group to start pressuring the State Department and the Pentagon to develop some kind of military program that would secure the spaces that they wanted to start exploiting. And in many ways, that's seen now as the role of AFRICOM in the long term.
Takufu, let's come back to you. And your film, African Independence, has a segment on AFRICOM. Tell us about that and what you know about U.S. interests now in the continent.
Well, Well, I mean, you know, in some ways you have to really be, I agree with what has been said, but you got to really be clear about the U.S. and its interest in Africa. So AFRICOM is a military arm, and we do need to understand the significance of military action in Africa. And let me just give you an example of that, and then I'll go to the other thing really quickly. So Libya had a president, Gaddafi, and he had made a lot of enemies in Europe and the United States. Ultimately, NATO begins to support what they call rebels, and they give them all kinds of support, their air support, they're dropping bombs, and they're doing all this stuff. And eventually, Gaddafi is killed in a very savage way on the news and all of this. And I'm not trying to excuse anything. I'm saying this happens. Now, what happens as a consequence of that is a lot of chaos in Libya, but the chaos spills over into Mali. The chaos spills over into Niger. Now, the destabilization of Libya on one hand, Tunisia on the other hand, Algeria on the other hand, the destabilization of the political situation in these countries begins to spread now to these other places, which are, you know, on the other side of Sahara. Now, this destabilization, and it has military implications because many of the soldiers who came to fight in northern Mali and that are fighting in northern Mali, many of them came through Libya. And, you know, some came from other places, and definitely many came to join the fight after it was started. But that the destabilization of Libya does not only impact Libya. So if you drop bombs in Libya, you're going to impact what's happening in Libya's neighbors. If you drop bombs in Mali, you're going to impact what happens to the countries that are on the borders of Mali. And we used to recognize this very clearly when there was apartheid and there was a battle against, you know, and the battle kind of crystallized in Namibia and South Africa, that you don't have a contained battle, that what happened in the Congo with all of these countries on the borders being involved in the war, that is a typical kind of thing. It's not that it's an exceptional thing. It just requires us to have a longer vision to see how the impact carries itself out. So to have a military force on the African continent without changing the relationships between Africa and the United States is bad for Africa. It is not enough to simply set up a military force. You have to change the relationships. And to change those relationships, you're going to have a different priority, which cannot simply be making profit for some lobbyist groups in the United States who want to, you know, increase the money in their pocket. So that many of the African leaders that I talk to, they argue very simply that if you look at Africa, you find it in a world where relationships among countries were defined after World War II. The UN was set up after World War II. And the politics of all these international organizations, the International Criminal Court, etc., all of them, the UN, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, they were all established in a world in which there were no independent African nations. African nations had no voice in those international organizations. And so Africa has been treated as a kind of sub-partner. And that's not tenable. And it, in fact, it invokes a kind of action on the part of those who believe that they're the more powerful and they're the people to add correction and solutions to problems, to not really entertain the strategic interests of those African nations. It's not only the strategic interests of the United States that should be considered, or the strategic interests of Europe that should be considered, but the strategic interests of Africa should be considered as well.
Tukufu Zubairi, we're going to have to wrap up the segment. We want to come back and have have Brian Murphy conclude for us. But I also wanted to say we have a giveaway here. We can give away five pairs of tickets to the showing of African Independence, which is on April 6th, Saturday at 5 p.m. at the San Leandro Performing Arts Theater. So we have five pair of tickets showing African Independence. April 6th, Saturday, 5 p.m. at the San Leandro Performing Arts Theater. And you can call now, 510-848-4425. So the first people that call in can get those tickets, 510-848-4425. And Dr. Zubairi, you're going to be there.
I will be there. So I'm looking forward to coming home.
Absolutely. It's going to be wonderful to see you there. So please call in now if you want some tickets to African Independence, 510-848-4425.
One quick question to Brian. And we've been hearing about, Molly, that Al-Qaeda insurgents are part of this process. We have to go in there. What's the validity of Al-Qaeda, Afghanistan Al-Qaeda folks, having some sort of subcommittee in Africa today?
Yes, that's been the main international news reporting on the so-called crisis, and people are being killed in Mali and the Saharan nations. But there's very little independent reporting going on from that part of the world. And there are many suspicions that what is called Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb could well be a fiction, a construction of some nation's military intelligence wishing to cause disruption in the region for very strategic interests. So although it's unfortunate that we see and hear of the suffering of people in Mali particularly and neighbor nations, the reasons why this is happening are very opaque, very, very gray, and we're not too clear exactly so far what's happening.
Well, Dr. Brian Murphy, thanks so much for joining us. Department of Communications, Niagara University. Dr. Takufu Zubairi, thank you for joining us. University of Pennsylvania sociologist. And your film, African Independence, will be playing here in the Bay Area April 6th, Saturday, 5 p.m. at the San Leandro Performing Arts Theater. If you want tickets, call now, 510-848-4425. We have five pair to give away. Thanks to you both for joining us, and we'll certainly have to come back to this subject another time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Kate Raphael of Women's Magazine will talk with members of the women's vocal ensemble Kitka, who are holding some special International Women's Day concerts this weekend in the Bay Area. We'll get in the mood by listening to a little bit of one of their signature pieces.
Chork, 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 chork. Touch foot like I'm gonna lick. Jork, 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 jork. Dad, we pee, josh, me, josh. Shut up, shut up, josh, me, josh.
Good morning. This is Kate Raphael of Women's Magazine here on this International Women's Day. Regular listeners to KPFA at this hour will be quite familiar with Kitka, the local women's vocal ensemble focusing on work from the Balkans, Caucasus, and Eastern Europe. Andrea Lewis, who hosted the morning show for many years and later Sunday Sedition, was a big Kitka fan and had them on many times. That's where I first heard their work and I fell in love with it. Kitka is based here in the East Bay, but they regularly perform all over the world and are frequent guests on national radio shows. Their 2009 album, Cradle Songs, was named one of the top 10 CDs by National Public Radio. And we are so lucky to have two of Kitka's singer-composers with us today. Kitka will be debuting Iron Shoes by Janet Katulis and Elizabeth Setzer's Apple Blossoms and Brine in concerts this weekend. Those will be in Oakland. The first one is tonight, and they will also be tomorrow and Sunday. All the shows are at 8 p.m. at Piedmont Piano Company. That's 1728 San Pablo Avenue in Oakland. Janet and Elizabeth, thanks so much for coming in.
It's our pleasure.
So, Janet, Iron Shoes is based on three separate Eastern European folk tales. Is that right?
Yes, kind of.
So tell us about them and how you decided to put those three together.
When I was a kid, I was kind of obsessed with this fairy tale that we had in a book of Russian fairy tales. And in this fairy tale, there was a woman who, through no fault of her own, ends up in some kind of a curse in which she's supposed to travel around and wear out three pairs of iron shoes and three iron staves and actually eat three loaves of iron bread before she can reach her ultimate goal and save people's lives, including her own, etc. When the idea of writing something for Kitka came up, I thought this might make some kind of good theme, because the idea of women wandering around in iron shoes, heavy and unempowered, and yet singing kind of Kitka-esque music in a somewhat powerful fashion sort of had an allure to me. And it turns out there's a lot of these fairy tales with women clanking around in iron shoes in Slavic folklore. So I had this idea that maybe there could be some scenario where a few of these women meet up together in the forest and join forces and share their stories and become maybe a little more powerful.
So Iron Shoes is intended to be a full-scale folk opera. Is that right? And this is just, I think the website called it a teaser concert.
Yeah, I hope someday it can be theatrically staged. For some reason, I imagine women wearing big cast iron frying pans on their feet to represent the iron shoes. So I imagine these giant musical chorus line dance numbers with women wearing frying pans on their feet.
Elizabeth, the website had a lot of information about Janet's journeys and development of Iron Shoes, but the section on Apple Blossoms and Brine is still to come. So the press release only said it's a song cycle about love and heartbreak. So first of all, what's a song cycle?
To me, a song cycle is essentially an album of songs with a certain flow from one to the other, so that each song gives a piece of a picture, and then all the songs together create the whole picture, and they take the listener and the performer through a journey.
Well, love and heartbreak are themes that are common to probably most of the songs ever written. What's unique about Apple Blossoms and Brine?
The songs are really inspired by experiences that are happening today, both in the local community, in Kitka's local community, and kind of things that we're sharing in the larger global community. One part of the cycle, which we debuted about a week and a half ago at our donor preview event, that part of the cycle, those two songs deal with death and loss. Just in Kitka's local circle, there's been a lot of loss recently. Death of friends, death of children to illness, death of partner. And then in the community at large, we've been seeing so much gun violence recently.
So is this the first time that you all will be doing shows that are completely composed of your own compositions?
Yeah, this is something completely new for Kitka.
In the past, Kitka has commissioned outside composers to write for the group, and Kitka singers themselves have always arranged folk melodies and folk songs for the group, but never come up with especially a whole program of new material based on the styles that we sing in.
You described the music as Kitka-esque. What does that mean?
The music that we sing has always seemed so, for want of a better word, I guess, mysterious to me, because some of the songs that we sing, these beautiful Georgian lullabies or some two-part Serbian calling song, these songs that we sing are sometimes so simple, but they're made up of so many little doodads and sparkly things, and they're hard to define or hard to pick apart sometimes. And what's been fun for me is to try to identify all those little features of the music that we sing, and which I think lend themselves really well to picturesque themes and sort of fairy tale magical things.
Keitka sings music from many different countries, and there's actually quite a big range of sounds and styles. People often think of Keitka as being, you know, our sound is restricted to a certain region, which is true, but within that region there's like a lot of diverse sound. So it's actually like a really rich palette to draw from. In the group, we've kind of embodied a sort of sonic language that sort of combines all of those sounds.
Let's listen to a little bit more of Keitka's music so people can get a feel for what we're talking about. We opened with an arrangement of yours, Janet, from the award-winning CD Cradle Songs. So, Elizabeth, let's hear one of the pieces you brought in. Tell us a little bit about it.
This is a recording of an arrangement I composed for the group of Joni Mitchell's Blue.
Songs are like tattoos, you know I've been.
This is PRN.FM,
PRN.FM,
the number one station for progressive minds.
Progressive minds.
Hello, this is Dr. Jack Rasmus, your host for the Alternative Vision show on the Progressive Radio Network. Alternative Visions interviews guests from grassroots America. The show's topics address the continuing economic and political crises in America. Alternative Visions differs from most radio shows. The focus is not only on understanding the crises, but discussing ideas on what can be done about it. Alternative Visions airs every Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. And if you don't catch us live, you can still listen 24/7 on the PRN website. Once again, that's PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartgles, the host of It's All About Food. Join me every Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m. I'll be talking with experts about my favorite subject, food. We'll be covering sustainable agriculture, health, environment, animal rights, and the latest culinary developments in vegan cuisine. Check out the archive for past shows on PRN or subscribe to the show on iTunes. It's All About Food. Don't miss it.
The Dr. Peter Breggin Hour interviews the most exciting innovators in the field of mental health, from therapists and researchers to advocates of patient rights. Join me and other pioneers in psychology, psychiatry, and empathic living with the aim of improving your life and the lives of everyone you touch. Wednesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Listen live or on the archives 24/7 at PRN.FM. Don't forget to rate the show on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
The story behind the story. Your story. My story. It's all in the mix on Lead Stories right here on PRN.FM. This is Eutrice Lead inviting you to share your thoughts and opinions and expand your knowledge about critical issues of the day, Monday through Friday, right after Gary Knowles' show. Listen live to a broadcast or get Lead Stories whenever you want from PRN's archive. You can even rate the show on iTunes. Now pass the word. Tell this story to everyone you know. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from Progressive Voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
feel personally that there's so much emotional depth in all of the sound that Kika makes, and in the feeling, the actual physical feeling of making that sound together. And it's often, you know, it's very mysterious even to us why, as American women, this music appeals to us so much that we would dedicate so much of ourselves and so much of our time and energy, not just to listening to it, but to learning how to actually make those sounds ourselves. It's just a real pleasure to kind of work with that and make new music that draws on all of the power of that sound.
I love singing Elizabeth's songs so much because they're each like little treasurous gems, and they're in English, which is a different thing for us. To be Kitka singing Kitka-esque music, but in English, is really special. Folk music is so much still a living thing, and it's so modern in a way. It's just as modern as it is ancient. You know, Kika has struggled in the past with kind of identity issues, like, oh, who are we singing this music from some village in Ukraine? You know, we're just these American girls. But I think over the years, we've really come around to feeling important in our roles as people who are helping to keep these songs alive and also pass them on to other people.
And the concerts are at the Piedmont Piano Company. To get tickets, people can go to the website, which is kitka.org, or, I mean, given that the first one is tonight, is there a phone number that people can call?
Actually, I can give out the Kitka office number, if that's helpful as well. It's in Oakland, so it's a 510 area code, and the number is 444-0323.
444-0323. I have been talking with Janet Katulis and Elizabeth Setzer, composers and vocalists with Kitka, one of the premier women's vocal ensembles in the Bay Area and in the nation. Thanks so much for coming on our show today.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is the Project Censored Show in the Morning Mix. Special thanks to Kate Raphael of Women's Magazine for that segment on Kitka. You can learn more at Kitka, K-I-T-K-A dot O-R-G. In our last segment today, we are joined by Inder Gurwal, who is a student at the City College of San Francisco, is a student in sociology, and he's here this morning to talk to us about what's been going on at City College of San Francisco with issues of accreditation and so forth. So, Inder, thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Please tell us, tell some folks here what's going on at City College San Francisco, certainly from your perspective as a student, and also let's talk. Once you do that, let's back out and talk about maybe some of the broader implications of what's happening at City College San Francisco, okay, because it's happening all across the state of California.
Well, last July, City College was sanctioned by the ACCJC, which is the Accreditation Commission for Community Colleges in California. And they were sanctioned from being fully accredited all the way down to show cause, which is a step before losing your accreditation and the school closing down. And what's happened ever since is just a huge mess. You know, a lot of myths and rumors have been circulated about City College. For example, rumors about how City College is bankrupt. And, you know, there have been numerous reports and studies showing that City College is not bankrupt, that it is just like any other community college in the state of California. It has lost millions of dollars due to budget cuts and due to the recession. Moreover, we've seen an interim administration be placed into City College of San Francisco, a special trustee who can veto the vote of the Board of Trustees, who are supposed to be accountable to the people of San Francisco and to the people of the school. So no longer is the leadership accountable to the people of City College. And moreover, there's an interim chancellor who is imposing these budget cuts without any kind of knowledge or understanding of how City College functions in the past or how, you know, City College serves the city of San Francisco. And really, this has left a lot of people concerned because the democracy that's going on at City College is no longer existing. Teachers and staff are no longer part of the collective bargaining agreements, and hence staff have been getting laid off. Teachers have been losing their benefits, and the most vulnerable are the students, because the students are now losing services, they're losing classes that are necessary for their education, such as, you know, computer lab hours, you know, being able to meet with counselors. So therefore, this is really hurting, you know, the workers and the students, those who are most, you know, integral to the City College community. And that's why, you know, I'm here today to talk about some of these implications to not only the City College, but, you know, to the community college system as well.
Now, students and faculty and other community people are organizing a march on the 14th.
Mm-hmm.
It's Defend City College San Francisco Public Education. The march is going to be at the San Francisco City Hall Thursday, March 14th in the afternoon. It's at 4 p.m. So how many students are we talking about at City College at this point?
Well, currently there are 85,000 students.
So we have 85,000 people, mm-hmm. faculty that's teaching all kinds of courses, many of whom, most of whom, in fact, are probably part-time faculty.
Yes.
Who just teach, you know, under contract, course by course, at a lower salary than a full-time person would. And it seems that one of the accreditation issues was this whole idea of democracy. The faculty had too much say. There weren't enough administrators controlling the campus in a real way. And how do the students feel about that?
Well, I mean, first of all, we have to understand why City College, you know, gave power to department chairs. You know, back in the early 90s, a bunch of scholars and experts in the educational field came in and said it would be most cost effective and provide best educational policy if you put power into the hands of department chairs and faculty. Now the Accreditation Commission is saying that, you know, it would be more cost effective if we hired more administrators. And the way students feel about it is this. You know, we believe that we have been getting a good education at City College, and if it's courtesy of the department chairs and the faculty being able to make decisions, then that's how we want to keep it. What we're seeing now is our services, our classes being cut because the school is being run by people who really can't empathize with the students.
It's also the case, isn't it, Ender, that what we're seeing here is more of a pedagogical Taylorism. Adam Bessie teaches English at DVC, Diablo Valley College, and has written about the corporatization and privatization of education and this top-down management model. And again, that doesn't seem to be working out for the students at CCSF.
Well, it's definitely not. And also, if you just go into the communities where the students come from, you know, you're seeing schools close down, such as elementary schools, middle schools, and you're seeing more prisons being built. So where do these students end up going? If you're closing down the schools, if you're cutting the services at the schools, you know, students are going to be sucked into the life, and the life that ends you, that leads you straight to prison or, you know, 6 feet under. So really what happens with this privatization top-down model isn't that that capitalists are making money, but like people who would provide dissent to the system are being phased out of the system completely and having their voices silenced.
We're speaking with Ender Agrawal, who is a student in sociology at City College of San Francisco. There are real threats to try to close the college. Is that also what we understand?
Well, I mean, that is the threat, to close a college, but it's to really make people accept the cuts that are happening. And the way we see it is whether the college closes or these cuts are implemented, for a lot of students, the school is closing down, because if you can't provide those service and classes, then a lot of students can't come to school.
Also, I just wanted to point out, and I wanted to hear what you have to say about this is from a student perspective, about how this has been framed in the local media, the corporate media in particular. Rick Sterling actually has a great piece on Beyond Cron, the voice of the rest, beyondcron.org. It's an open letter to the SF Chronicle on their coverage of the CCSF crisis and the reporting of Ms. Asimov there. Rick Sterling has a great piece pointing out factual errors, the narrow scope and misleading sensationalism and a lack of investigation into the big picture of what's going on there. Does that sound accurate to you?
Definitely. I mean, the San Francisco Chronicle, as well as, you know, a couple other news sources in San Francisco, have really distorted the real story at City College, have given people false information, and really prevented people from taking a stance or making an effort to really understand what's going on for themselves and getting the correct factual information so that they know how to proceed.
So where do we go from here?
Well, really, what the students, the teachers, and community members are now doing is coming together, you know, showing the city of San Francisco, showing the school that City College belongs to San Franciscans. It belongs to the people of the Bay Area. It's our college. So for an interim administration, for a special trustee to come in and impose cuts and then eventually leave a few months later, you know, is unacceptable. So we have to come together. We have to become self-informed, inform one another, and then, you know, pressure our politicians, pressure those who are supposed to be accountable to us to really take control of what belongs to the city and the people of San Francisco.
Are we allowing these accreditation groups to too much power in the control over community colleges? I mean, standards are one thing, but professors are pretty darn good at setting standards for departments and internally. So this external accreditation group, the ACCJC, from your perspective, do they have too much power in this?
I think so. I mean, I think that initially they're really supposed to just recommend and provide standards and really advise schools to meeting those standards. However, now they're saying that they're not so much providing recommendations or providing requirements, you know, mandates that schools have to implement. And really, this accrediting team that came in last July, it consisted of 13 administrators and just 3 faculty. So you're really getting it from an administrator, you know, business perspective, and not so much from the perspective of good educational policy.
We've been speaking with Ender Agarwal, student at City College of San Francisco. And if you want to learn more, you can go to saveccsf.org. And if you want to help keep the community in community college, there's a March 14th mass rally at 4 p.m. at San Francisco Civic Center. Inder, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
That about does it for today. We have a series of announcements to make. It's the second anniversary of the Fukushima meltdown. Nuclear whistleblowers, health and safety workers, and our communities. That's Saturday, March 9th, 2013, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at City College of San Francisco. Yet another community service that's being offered there. So if you're interested, that's Saturday, March 9th, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Nuclear whistleblower, health and safety. We're going to be hearing from Paul Garner and Lewis, David Baer, and many others. We also have another announcement, Peter.
This is up in Santa Rosa tomorrow night. The KWTF celebrates International Women's Day. This will be at the Arlene Francis Center, 99 6th Street, downtown, starting at 6:30 p.m. There will be poetry, art, food, music, a really wonderful time, $8 at the door.
And also,
night, 6
and
p.m.
Also, we have one more announcement for this morning at Gaia's Garden International Vegetarian Buffet, 1899 Mendocino Avenue in Santa Rosa, Thursday, March 14th. This is Thursday night at 6 p.m. Dispatches from the Media Revolution. Join Project Censored for an evening of delicious food and independent news analysis. I'll be there with Peter Phillips, Andy Roth, Ken Burrows, Susan Rahman, KPFA's Tara Drabji, and Project Censored students to talk about Censored 2013 and to have a great dinner. So we hope you can join us at Gaia's Garden Thursday, March 14th at 6 p.m. I'd like to thank our guests today, Takufu Zuberi and Brian Murphy. We were speaking about Africa. I'd like to thank Kate Raphael for producing the Women's Magazine segment on the vocal ensemble Kitka. Thanks to Inder Agarwal, student at City College of San Francisco, for talking about the issues there. Thanks to Anthony Fest and Kirsten Thomas at the controls. We will see you next week. You are listening to 94.1 FM KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. Find out more about Project Censored at projectcensored.org and follow us on Facebook. Have a good weekend.